This is the panel on farmers markets and local agriculture. My name is Dennis Dimmick. I'm executive editor for Environment at National Geographic. A couple of seconds of backstory to help you understand how this came to be. I'm a graduate of the Ag Journalism Program here in Madison years ago. It's currently called Life Sciences Communications. Thank you, Dan. And when I graduated, some of my advisors thought, great, we're going to turn you into the next great advertising executive in Chicago so that you can market, do all the marketing and propaganda for the large agri-industrial corporations. And I said, I don't think so. And so what I did is I went back to my home in Oregon and began a career in journalism and have focused heavily on agricultural issues for the last 30 years in National Geographic. We published an article in December of 95 on the sustainable agriculture movement, of which this panel is essentially about. Last January, when we began organizing this conference, SEJ members were solicited as to what they thought might be a good panel, and I thought to myself, wait a minute, Madison, Saturday morning, farmers market, largest farmers, producer-only farmers market in the United States, there's a great chance here to talk about sort of the issues behind local food and local agriculture, and then for those of you who wish to go actually see it in action. So we have both lecture and lab today. This is a great opportunity for you to both talk about it and then go see it in action. And that's so what we have today is a panel of three people. The panel was organized graciously by Dan Sullivan, who's a freelance journalist, formerly of Rodale. He's here. He's going to take anybody who wants. Dan, why don't you hold your hand up so everybody sees. Anybody who wants to, after the end of the formal session, Dan is going to take you up if you can't find it. It's like you can't miss it. It's right in the Capitol Square, the farmers market. And but right now what we're going to do is to try to go through the talk to three people who are deeply involved in this movement. We have Claire Strader, who runs the Troy Community Farm on Madison's north side. Just briefly, last October, Michael Pollan wrote a letter in the New York Times Magazine to the as-yet-unnamed president at that time, saying that the president ought to put a garden on the south lawn of the White House. And a group of agricultural activists started an online poll as to who that farmer should be to help guide the new president into growing that garden. And Claire won that poll. So not only we'll let her talk to you about her work at Troy Community Farm, both as a farmer, as an educator. We have Jerry McGeorge here of Organic Valley Farmers Co-op. Organic Valley is the largest independent farmer-owned organic dairy cooperative. What co-ops are, for those of you who are unfamiliar, this is from my ag classes. They're organizations. They're farmer-owned. The idea is to aggregate both purchasing and selling power for farmers and also to do things like marketing and establish brand identity. And our Organic Valley is markets all over the United States. And we have Margaret Crome, who is policy director at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute, which is dedicated to research, education, and innovation in sustainable agriculture, and she coordinates the policy efforts. You see, not only is it sort of an on-the-ground thing in terms of the work and the business, like what Jerry is involved in, but it's also you need to be, if you want to grow this movement and have an increased role, you have to work on the national level to also be working with USDA and the Congress and sort of trying to provide vehicles that allow this kind of effort to thrive. So what I've asked each of our speakers, I'll start with Claire, so each one can sort of explain, you know, what they do, who they are, how they see this movement, and I'll start with Claire. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's right.
So why don't you speak in the microphone because they're recording the session.
I'll lean in. So the first thing I always like to say when I introduce myself is a really obvious fact that people notice about me is that I have no hair, and everybody always wonders what that's about. So I just was born that way. I just don't have hair. So now you all know. I think word is slowly spreading around Madison. Did you know that, Margaret? That that's why I have no hair? No.
No,
I just don't have any hair. That's all. I don't.
I have known other people. No, I didn't.
There we go. I was scared, especially. As Dennis said, I'm an educator, and I've worked with middle school students and younger students. And when I have come into their classrooms to do a little, class on math and how you would figure out how many carrots you need to plant to feed 100 people or something like that, I always start with the no hair introduction, and they get really quiet. They look at me and they think, "I'm pretty sure this is the most interesting thing you're going to say all day." So yeah, I want to know why you don't have any hair. So now you all know too. I am the farm manager for Troy Community Farm on the north side of Madison. Troy Gardens is a project on the north side. It's a place and a project on the north side that combines a 5-acre certified organic farm, which is the piece that I do. There's a 4-acre prairie and natural areas restoration on the property. There's a 4-acre community garden, which is one of the biggest community gardens in Madison. And there's also a 5-acre co-housing site with 30 units of housing, two-thirds of which, so 20 of those units, are affordable, meaning they're owned by the Madison, or the land under all of those houses is owned by the Madison Area Community Land Trust. And 20 of those units are sold at below market rate, and their price is kept low forever. There's a limit on how much the current homeowners can make off of that property. So it helps get people into homes more affordably and keeps, as I said, those homes affordable in the long run. So those are sort of the four land masses at Troy Gardens. And each, there's an overlay, I guess, excluding the co-housing. The organization that I work for is called Community Groundworks at Troy Gardens. And we steward the 26 acres that are not the housing. So it's a combined project, but we are in charge of those open acres, so the farm, the natural areas, and the community gardens. And there's this overlay of education on all of that. So there's a kids garden in the community gardens where, I can't remember the number this year, it's probably up to 1,000 kids from across Madison come and grow some food. Mostly they harvest and make that food into salsa or pickles or something yummy and eat it. Turns out they actually don't like to weed very much. But they will cram those tomato plants in there, and then they'll enjoy eating that salsa afterward. There's also education associated with the community gardens and the farm as well, which is the easiest part for me to speak about since it's the part that I know. So we have 10 interns on the farm this year. That number kind of ebbs and flows each year. There's more and more interest in sustainable agriculture, so there's more and more people who are interested in learning how to grow food for themselves and for their communities. So just as an indicator for that particular internship program, we had it was about 35 applicants this year for 10 positions in Madison, and these are unpaid positions. So the people are very interested in learning about sustainable agriculture. We had a very successful season that way. And then there's a bunch of other education things that happen there that I will spare you the details of, though I can answer questions on them if you're interested. And some other things that we're doing. So why is my heart in this movement? Why do I want to do this? So like Dennis gave a little bit of a backstory, I can say that I studied philosophy and women's studies in college, and the thing that I really took away from that was that I didn't participate very much in meeting the basic necessities of my staying alive on this planet, like growing food and making clothes and making shelter. So when I graduated from college, I decided I wanted to learn about each of those things. And for the most part, I have succeeded. So I went and did an apprenticeship on an organic vegetable farm and learned how to grow food without the intention of becoming a farmer. That was sort of a concept. Turned out I liked it, so I kept going. I learned how to knit and sew. Make some of my own clothes. And I also grew a house. We grew a partner that I had at the time when we were starting a new farm. We bought property, and it needed to have cover crops on it in order to get that land remediated and ready to grow food on. So we grew a cover crop of rye, which is pretty common. And while that rye was growing, we also needed to build a house. There was nothing on the property. So we harvested this rye seed and sold it for cover crop seed. and then baled, had our neighbors, we didn't have this equipment, asked our neighbor to come and bale that rye straw, and we built a straw bale house from that with the help of some builders, because we're not builders. But so I was able to cover sort of all of those pieces. It's been a lot of hard work, and now I'm mostly now I just knit and grow food. I don't work with straw bale anymore. But we are building a passive solar greenhouse at Troy as well, so that the if all goes well, it will not need any supplemental heat, and we'll be able to grow starts for the farm and also to sail to the many community gardeners in Madison, and to hopefully bring in a little bit more income for our project at Troy as well. So there's basic overview of what I do and why I care about it, because I actually do want to participate in the things that keep me alive.
Okay, Claire, two quick questions. One, the future of a farm is typically rooted in who owns the land. So what is the tenure of the land that the garden is on? How did that come to be? Is it owned by the community garden now? And two, of your interns, I mean, since their time with you, have you had them go off and establish their own kinds of gardens that are like yours?
Yeah, those are good questions. Land tenure is huge and difficult in the Madison area because land is really expensive. So this project, Troy Gardens on the North Side, happened because a group of neighbors got together and wanted to save this land that was going to be sold to, the state owned it, it was going to be sold to the highest bidder, so basically developers for more housing. And the Madison Area Community Land Trust, the North Side, North Side Planning Council, some folks from the university, and Community Action Coalition, which is a community gardener organization here in Madison, all got together to preserve that land. And then with the help of the city, that land was purchased by the Madison Area Community Land Trust. So they are the landowners, and Community Groundworks at Troy Gardens has a long-term lease on that land, on the 26 acres that I talked about. So our tenure is secure. As long as we do the things that we've agreed to do, there's also a conservation easement on the land, which is held by the Center for Resilient Cities here in Madison. So as long as we don't build houses on it or do something that's not in the conservation easement, our tenure is secure. And I am proud to say that some of the interns at the farm have gone on to run their own farms here in the Madison area. They also, Ginny, who worked with Margaret also this year, is right now we're talking with her about how she can get some land. She's finding land around Madison and is planning to start a small farm next year and get involved in some farmers markets. She's worked with us at Troy for 2 years. And there have been other folks who've gone on to do degrees in agroecology or agronomy at the university. So, yeah, they definitely have kept their hands in. And I think even those who haven't gone on to farm or start their own sort of larger projects, I know that they grow their own food. At least they have community gardens.
Great, thank you. So, Jerry, tell us the story of Organic Valley and what the role of cooperatives in enhancing the financial stability of small farmers.
Sure. Okay, so we're starting out a little bit with stories about how we got here, and so I'll quickly tell mine. My educational and professional background before I started working at Organic Valley was in social work. I lived in Chicago and I worked with disadvantaged youth on the south side of the city, which was the most difficult job I ever had. And I guess you'd say I was suffering a little bit from burnout. My wife and I, with young children, also had decided we didn't want to live in the city anymore. So we moved a couple hours west of here. It's called the Driftless region of Wisconsin, and it happens to be where Organic Valley is located. Also happens to be where my father lived. I have a longtime connection to that area. And my father was instrumental in helping start Organic Valley, and longtime friend of the current CEO, George Seaman. George at one point approached me about working at Organic Valley, which I found very flattering since I had absolutely no business background whatsoever. And yet I was intrigued and ended up interviewing with him, and I was still pretty leery. I certainly didn't think of myself as somebody that was going to get involved in business. But the thing that George said that hooked me, and he knew my background, he said, Jerry, you're interested in issues of social justice and social work, and I'm here to tell you that what we're doing in Organic Valley is the truest social work that there is. And I went away thinking about that. and I realized that, you know, issues related to our food and issues related to the production of that food were truly issues of social justice, if you will. So that's kind of how I got there, and that was 12 years ago. It was one of the best decisions I've ever made. I really enjoyed the time there. I think that Organic Valley is a wonderful organization. And, you know, so how are we structured? Well, as Dennis started, we're a cooperative. And what that means for us is it means that the farmers that produce the product that we market own the business. And, you know, when I started, that was 150 farmers in mainly the upper Midwest. And today it's about 1,300 farmers in about 30 different states. So we've expanded dramatically in the 12 years that I've been part of the organization. That idea of the structure of a co-op is really one of what I'd call the three pillars upon which Organic Valley is built, and Dennis spoke to it a little bit, but really the reason that those founding farmers that started the organization decided that they wanted to organize as a cooperative, they wanted to have control over the decision-making process, and they felt that this was a structure that would allow them to do that. They were tired of being parts of organizations that made decisions that they didn't necessarily think were in their best interest. And I think it's also true to say what they really wanted to do and what they were very good at was farming. They did not want to spend the time marketing their product necessarily, but they also felt that if they could come together and aggregate their production and start building a brand, that would give them a presence in the marketplace that they felt was very important. And so that's kind of what we set about doing. And, you know, as I mentioned, we've expanded rapidly. You can basically find us anywhere in the country at this time. Now, a couple other things that we're built on. Number one, organic. Everything we sell is certified organic, and it's been that way since day one. And secondly, support of family farms. And so typically the scale of our farms is much smaller than, for instance, some of our competitors. We do have a range for sure, but for instance in the dairy, and when I speak about Organic Valley, we have a wide variety of products that we market, but approximately 90% of all of our revenues come from dairy. So if we have about 1,000 dairy farms, the average size is probably about 60 cows, which in today's day and age is a pretty small operation. Let's see. One of the things that we really have spent some time on, and I think this relates to the subject at hand today, regional or local food, is that we think of ourselves as a national cooperative with a regional focus. And what I mean when I say that is we have pools of producers in various areas throughout the country. And what we do then is we aggregate that production in those areas, and we're using production by and large in those regional areas to service the markets there. So even though, as I said, you know, there's farmers in 30 states at this point, we, you know, for instance, have a group of farmers in the Pacific Northwest. Their products are going to be sold in the, you know, Seattle, Portland, areas like that. We have the Northeast, California, Texas. One of the newer regions would be the Southeast with farmers located in sort of the area where North Carolina, Virginia, and Tennessee come together. And we have farmers in all three of the states. But then those farmers are going to be aggregating their production, and it's going to be used in those kinds of markets. And I guess the other thing I'd say about that is that means then that we have regional partners for the processing. And one of the sort of basic things that we chose to do was not invest our time, our money, and our effort into owning production processing plants. We look for partners, and we look for partners on a regional basis to help us with that. So regionally based farmers, regionally based production facilities to service regional based markets, and that really is a kind of a cornerstone of how we try and market the products of our farmers. And of course, the other side of that then is we do want to use that that identity in our marketing. We want consumers to know, guess what? If you're purchasing Organic Valley milk and you live in New York City, it probably came from upstate New York. So
Jerry, are any of your member farmers, for example, I mean, what you're doing is aggregating products from farmers and then distributing them. Are any of your member farmers actually involved in direct marketing to buyers, like, for example, what we're seeing at the farmers market?
That's a good question. And some of our farmers certainly are involved beyond Organic Valley. They also are doing some of their own direct marketing. And a lot of that happens, you know, I talked about the dairy being 90%, but we also have eggs, produce, and meat products. And particularly in the produce and the meat area, the farmers that we have, often they're using us as part of their marketing, but then they may go to the, you know, have more local markets, local food co-ops, local farmers markets, things of that nature. So, yes, some of that does happen.
I'm going to turn to Margaret now on the matter of policy in agriculture, and I guess I'll just use an example. I think that it's, for any of you who've seen the Robert Kenner film Food Inc., you realize that subsidized calories in the food system are pretty cheap, and it's tough to make unsubsidized food affordable to a lot of people. It's cheaper to go buy stuff that cheap corn products than it is often to go buy fresh foods and fruits. So, and you work in the policy arena, and you're always trying to figure out how to make it possible for this kind of local food to not only survive but to grow and thrive across the country. Why don't you tell us about your work?
Sure. And my background is a little bit idiosyncratic also. I was an English literature major way back in University of Virginia, way back in the 1970s. And when you are an English literature major, everybody says, well, of course you're going to be a lawyer, which I didn't really want to do. But I did work for a legal aid advocate and a lobbyist in Washington for 4 years, having no interest in being a lawyer the entire time. But I grew a little weary of the Washington scene. I felt it was pretentious, and for some variety of reasons, I ended up feeling this is probably not the place of which my career dreams are made. And so I did one of those workshops called What Color is Your Parachute? Or something like that. And what are you going to become? And it was obvious to everybody around me that what I really wanted to do was more of the, you know, natural resources, environmental issues, and that I really cared about the developing world. So I went into the Peace Corps, and I really had the most wonderful job doing agroforestry work, but trying to translate that back into the United States, I found myself writing toward all of my graduate schools the term sustainable agriculture. And it was a time when that wasn't a term that people used, capital S, capital A. But it really became, it just happened that by good luck, my understanding of what I wanted to do coincided with the emergence of the movement awfully thoughtfully. And I got an internship upon coming to UW. I over-applied and got into schools all over the country. And then how do you make a choice? So I just took an Amtrak pass and toured the country. And I hit Madison on a horribly snowy day, having come from a very hot part of Africa. I just loved it. And I love polka dancing, and I love the whole culture, and I love the rural community. I mean, everyone here was kvetching about it, and I thought, wow, this is it. I'm here. And it has been thus always ever since. And it was interesting that I got hired as an intern. Though I had left Washington not wanting to do policy, I was hired for my quote-unquote Washington experience. And it has been interesting that what do I do now? Policy. It's funny, isn't it? But the things that I love about working in the field of sustainable agriculture is that it's a field that you probably experience in environmental journalism. There's a lot of passion. People who want to work in this field want to work in it because they are concerned about our food system. They're concerned about the well-being of our farmers. They're concerned about the quality of our land. They're concerned about the injustice of our food system. And now a lot of people are very concerned about the implications of climate change upon agriculture and the consequences of agricultural practices upon climate change. There are lots and lots of these issues. And so it's a place, it happens that sustainable agriculture as a movement is filled with people who don't have sharp elbows. We kind of help each other. Somebody needs a grant, we help each other find grants. You know, it's a very good and collaborative community by and large. The kinds of issues that we work on at the federal level synergize tremendously well with policy at the state level and at the local level. And I do policy work at all of those levels. I sit on the Board of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection for the state of Wisconsin. And at the federal level, I coordinate nationwide the appropriations campaign for federal sustainable ag programs. By the way, I don't do talks without encouraging people to get on the action alert list, the information list for the group that is the most potent force nationally in terms of sustainable ag policy. It's called the National Sustainable Ag Coalition. And if somebody felt like circulating this, I would be awfully grateful if somebody wants to step up and would you do that? Thank you so much, Claire. This is the organization which is more than any other nationally responsible for the changes we've made. For example, you're going to be touring the farmers market here in Dane County. All around the country, farmers markets have exploded. One of the programs that we started in the 2002 Farm Bill took forever to get it funded, and finally we got it funded and crept up in this most recent Farm Bill. We got an increased amount for it, and it's growing. That's the Farmers Market Promotion Program. It supports farmers markets. It supports farm stands. It supports community-supported agriculture, CSAs. Do you all know what I mean by that? Okay. And that's a perfect example of the tremendous synergy between doing on-the-ground work. I was passionate about keeping the Farmers Market Promotion Program on our appropriations agenda because I had worked in the ground in helping to set up another one of these cool institutions around Madison called the Madison Area CSA Coalition. This is back in 92. We just had a bunch of farmers kept calling me, talking about, I'm interested in selling into Madison. Can you help me? And finally, I thought, you know what we ought to do is pull together a meeting to see about setting up not a single CSA, but a network of CSAs. And Claire, I think you were one of the very first farmers of that group. And it has proven to be extraordinarily successful. We started off with 8 farms that first summer of 93, which you may or may not remember was a very flooded year in the Midwest, a terribly tough year to start. And we found the coolest thing. Some of the farmers would say, well, I've got a rotten crop of potatoes, but I've got a lot of these, and the farmers began exchanging to help each other out so that they could continue to offer enough diversity for each other. It was very exciting. Now, Madison Area CSA Coalition, which we always called MERF, Madison Eaters Revolutionary Front. But Madison MACSAC, you'll find on the website. If you go to MACSAC, you'll see they now have 35 farmers and more demand than possible to meet currently.
So it's the mechanism basically that if I'm interested in participating, I get a subscription or I sign up. I mean, trying to take a step back and explain CSA concept.
Sure, the CSA concept is essentially that if you're the consumer and I'm the farmer, you'll pay up front at the beginning of the year for a subscription, and I will once a week either deliver to you or to a drop-off site, or you'll pick up at the farm a box or a bag, a container of wonderful, fresh, locally produced, in many cases organic. It's not inherent in the description, but it's the kind of produce that you want because you've subscribed. And it allows me as a farmer to have the upfront money I need. I don't have to go to the bank to get the seeds and the inputs I need to start my farm, and it guarantees that floody year or not, I'll end up having an income because we're sharing the risk of that farm. You have the kind of control that you want over how your food is produced. I have the kind of assurance that I need, and so it's a shared risk enterprise. And within one of the things starting with Madison is that we've always had a commitment to making available shares for low-income consumers. So that's the essential concept. I want to just mention a couple other things around Madison local policy that I think are important and exciting. About this time last year, I had a fundraiser at my house for a local candidate, and a fellow greeted me by my fireplace and said, "Oh, I'm Kyle Richmond. I'm the chair of the county board's Environment, Ag, Natural Resources Committee." And I said, "Great, nice to meet you." He said, "You know, I kind of blew it. I had invited you to come meet with our committee, and I kind of forgot." And I said, "Well, I've had my time busy enough, not a problem." And he said, "Are you interested in coming?" So I went and chatted with the county board's Environment, Ag, Natural Resources Committee about sustainable agriculture policy. And I said, "You know, I don't do local policy much, but if you're interested, I'm willing to climb up that learning curve with you." Well, they decided they wanted to, and this past year has been so exciting. We've had a committee, a subcommittee named Sustainable Agriculture Subcommittee. We've had four work groups working on four aspects of sustainable ag, determined by a very extensive group process, vetting process. But the four topics are beginning farmers. You can't have a sustainable agriculture if you don't have farmers continuing to come in. Farmland preservation and conservation. If your land base isn't secure, as Claire so well put, then, and if you're not protecting the land in the long run and the natural resources, the air, the water, the wildlife, soil, you're not going to have a sustainable agriculture. The third work group is on farmer profitability. Farmers aren't making money. It isn't sustainable. And the last one is on urban agriculture and community food security. It has to be accessible to all for it to be truly sustainable, and it has to be something that people can do whether they're in the rural areas or locally. So Claire has been involved in one of these work groups, the one on urban agriculture and community food security, and all these work groups have been putting together their recommendations. The county executive last week in her budget statement acknowledged and affirmed this effort and says she wants to work with us. And so that's just another indication, kind of new, exciting, cutting-edge moment here.
Okay, two questions, and then in a couple minutes we're going to open it to you, SEJ members. First, you'll need to identify yourself. The first question is, what are the challenges on the national level in terms of policy, USDA, Congress, the kinds of program, sort of goals and programs that you're looking forward to trying to be engaged in? And two, what do you do about, I mean, it, you're talking about low-income shares in Madison, but how do you make this kind of food affordable for people who otherwise couldn't afford it? Now, I mean, what can be done so that people aren't going to go to buy processed food because it's cheaper calories than the calories that are available through these kinds of food programs?
That's such a great question, and I'd love to explain it. And I'll give you an example. Again, I mean, we are Madisonophiles, I might as well say. I mean, it's true. I was in Davis, California last weekend at their farmers market, by the way, and they had a sign that said, voted America's favorite farmers market. And I thought, no. But anyhow, Madison's got all sorts of ferment on these issues. And one of the totally exciting things was that a few years ago, one of the subscribers to one of our CSAs, one of our community-supported agriculture farms, worked for one of our HMOs, our local HMOs, health maintenance organizations. And they had this totally interesting idea. How about if we were to offer a subsidy to our members if they were to become a member of a local CSA? Because we're so confident that the quality of the food and the access to fresh, well-produced, healthy local fruits and vegetables will make a difference in their health, that it ought to be a benefit to us to do that. And this idea, I just mentioned it to a few people around the country once I heard about it. Oh my gosh, I couldn't get my email cleared. Everyone was so excited about this neat idea. And it has, as an example of one of the innovations, it doesn't always require policy. Market innovations can help offer local access. I've also mentioned the local sustainable agriculture, the local Madison Area CSA Coalition's approach, which is to actually set aside some money. But there are other important strategies. One of the problems associated with access to affordable food is that it's not just a question of being able to get there. It's also knowing that you want to and being motivated and being given an educational message about why it's important. And it's tremendously important that our children in schools, for example, begin to learn about the importance of good nutrition and that they take that message home. So I just was in Des Moines, Iowa, the last 2 days working on the national farm to school initiative, thinking through the strategy for that group, because we really want to have Michelle Obama's great garden and her messages about nutrition. We want that to be around the nation in every school. Now, there are lots of different ways local communities can support making this more affordable. I've given you one, but there are communities that make it possible for farmers, for local members to have access to the community gardens that Claire was talking about. And there are many opportunities for communities to use local land so that local folks can get access to that food. There are strategies. Do we have the will to do it is the question. Do we as a nation have the commitment to address the food which is driving our health issues around obesity, around heart disease? Do we have the commitment to deal with these health issues? It should be part of the healthcare debate. And if we understand it in those terms, we will need to make those changes. Now, as to the federal policy questions around sustainable agriculture, our agenda really does cover very much the same breadth of those that I mentioned before. We help work on creating programs to support beginning farmers and ranchers. We work on helping to support the national or helping farmers make transitions to organic agriculture. We work on programs, the Value-Added Producer Grant Program, to help farmers reclaim the value, not just growing wheat and not having somebody else convert it into pasta, but making that conversion yourself, helping to establish the cooperative so that you can actually reclaim the value so that you can get the benefit from the food that dollars that people spend, and on conservation programs that actually reward farmers. Conservation stewardship programs are a great example. Helps to reward farmers for doing the right thing, not paying them to grow more and more monocrops that are hard on the land. Get the sense of the agenda there?
How do you get, then, in this National School Lunch Program, how are you going to get this kind of food in the program instead of just giving schools surplus commodity crops?
Well, you may or may not know, but coming up this coming year is a program. It's a big national reauthorization. That just basically means that Congress every several years revisits the galaxy of legislation around it, and around, it's called the Child Nutrition Reauthorization. In that, it is in that context that these issues of school nutrition will be brought up. And that the question of how do we create the effective coalition has a lot to do with you all. It has to do with your communicating to your members, to your listeners, your readers, why it matters to have us bring in, smack into the agenda of child nutrition, the question of sustainability and giving children the access to fresh locally food and to supporting our agricultural base as we do.
Okay, I'm going to open to questions, and I've been asked to repeat questions. So SEJ members first. Anybody? Okay, on the far right. Yes, ma'am. Okay, the question is on how CSAs and HMOs could work together to provide greater benefit to low-income people. Fair?
Well, the way it works in Madison, Margaret explained it, Troy Community Farm is a member of MACSAC. I'm actually one of the board members of MACSAC as well. And the way it works here is that there are four local health insurance providers in Madison that agree to provide a rebate to their members who join CSAs, and those CSAs have to be part of a CSA coalition, which MACSEC is, so that the health insurance company has a way to ensure that it is a legitimate CSA where the CSA members will actually get good, high-quality food on a regular basis. So it's up to MACSEC, that CSA coalition, to admit and endorse farms that will meet that standard, which is a big deal for us as MAXAC. But once that happens, it's pretty simple for the insurance company. Then they just have a form, usually online, that the member will fill out and send in with some proof from the farm that member, that individual or household did join that CSA. And typically it can be a canceled check. It can also be the introductory email from the farmer that says, I've got your payment, you're signed up, here's when your first delivery will be. So it is pretty straightforward. And then those individual households pay for that membership up front. They provide proof to the insurance company that they did purchase that membership, and then the insurance company rebates them. In Madison, it can be anywhere from as low as $50 up to, I believe, $300, depending on the number of people who have an insurance policy in the family with that HMO, and also the amount that they paid for the share as well.
Okay. Wendy?
Wendy Riedahl, University of Colorado, and I also write for a couple of blogs on environmental issues. And I have a question for Jerry. I buy your Organic Valley milk in Boulder and pay about $3.30 a half gallon, I'd say, average for it, which, you know, seems reasonable. And I've always, I thought I understood that the farmers that are part of the cooperative set the prices. So I was really surprised a few days ago. I did a little traveling prior to the conference, and I was up in Minocqua, and I was in a supermarket up there, and they had, you know, a whole wall of regular milk and a little bit of Organic Valley half gallons, $5.19. Is that the grocery store trying to capitalize on a small demand in that market? Or I was just curious. I guess it ties into that whole challenge of pricing things so people can afford them, and I thought that was even out of my price range.
Okay, just... I just have to do this for the tape. So the question is about the price disparity region to region between Organic Valley milk, why it's more expensive in some regions than others.
Okay, that's a great question, and you brought up something that I'm going to expand upon a little bit, which is this idea of our farmers participating in setting the price that they receive for their product. And this, again, is one of the sort of bedrock things that we were founded on. Our farmers were saying, look, I'm not making enough money, and you know, it's hard for me to envision staying on the land. I'm not sure my kids should come back to the farm. I'm not sure I even want to tell them to come back to the farm. And also, in the dairy world, there's this the pricing is very volatile. And so that was another issue. You know, we'd have farmers who, over a month or couple, 3 month period, could see prices fluctuate 30-40%. Didn't always happen, but certainly could happen. And you know, when I talk with folks, I always bring up, how would you do if, you know, you received your paycheck, what you expected, and then the next one came in and it was 30% less than what you had gotten the time before. So anyway, trying to set up a system where both sustainable and stable pay prices are offered to our farmers has been a bedrock piece of it. And they do participate with the management of the cooperative on a yearly basis in looking at what those prices are and giving feedback and setting the prices. They don't do it entirely. You know, management is part of that decision making as well. But basically, yes, that's what we do. And so then when we go to retailers or distributors, we're very, very transparent. We say, okay, we start right here. This is what our farmers need to continue to produce the high-quality product that you want on your shelves and your consumers are asking for. And then we go through it from there. Here's the freight cost. Here's, you know, the packaging cost. Here's everything that goes into the price of that. And, oh, by the way, we want a small profit on top of that. And so we're very transparent with them. And it's disarming in a way when they start coming back at us and say, let's drive. We want to see you drive the price down. We want a better deal. And you know, we look at them and say, well, where do you want that to come from? Do you want it to come out of the farmer's pocket? Because that's really what you're asking us to do. We can't have a whole lot of effect on some of the, you know, let's say the freight or the packaging. Maybe we can, but significant. Where's the quote easy way to go? take it out of the farmer's pay. And we're not willing to do that. And so it's worked very well for us. Now, to answer your specific question, there is a little bit of regional difference in our pay for our farmers, but not to the level that you're bringing up. And so, you know, once we sell it to a distributor, it's a little bit out of our hands. That does seem excessive, but, you know, at that point, we don't have a whole lot of control. So I think, yes, the answer to your question would be that the retailers or the distributors end up putting a margin on that, and some are going to go much higher than others.
Okay. On the left.
I'm Bill Dietrich with Western Washington University. The incoming freshmen this year are reading Omnivore's Dilemma. And so we're having a discussion on campus, and I'm going to be on a panel. I like the book. I admire the book. The book also struck me, though, as just a little bit precious with my upper-class guy. And so my question, I guess, is this a sort of a phenomenon of the intellectual elite? You know, you have to pay more. Downtown to go to the market, you have to spend hours and hours cooking your slow food and so on, or are you starting something that really could be a model for all Americans at all times?
Okay, in summary, I guess the question is, based on Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, is the local food movement a phenomenon of the intellectual elite or something other?
I think that is a really hard question. I too have read the book a couple of times and talked about it in a book club that I'm part of, and this exact question was a big topic for us in this book club. And I don't feel like we came to any really good conclusions. I guess for me personally, I feel like it has to start somewhere, and I don't know, I'm hoping Margaret has something more interesting to say than what I'm about to say, because because I feel like that is it. There are a lot of pieces of it, and Margaret did speak to it already somewhat. You know, it is about culture, and it is about where we choose to put both our money and our time. And for some folks in our society, those choices are a lot easier than they are for others of us. But because it is being talked about more, because Michael Pollan is writing books, because you all are writing articles and doing reports on. You know, getting the word out to us as a population that food and agriculture are important in our lives, I feel like it will slowly start to change. And what if, I don't know, Margaret, when you're working policy, I have this idea that this came out of our discussion of the Omnivore's Dilemma and also of In Defense of Food and watching Food, Inc. And I thought we could do so much to help people have more money to purchase good food if we stopped producing sodas. They're not cheap. There's a fair number of calories in there. We all know what kind of calories they are, but sodas are not cheap. And if we just didn't have those anymore, maybe we could buy more pears and broccoli.
Well, when I think of this issue, I think of my friend in Chicago, LaDonna Redman. And, you know, LaDonna is African-American, is living in inner cities, not now, but was at the time that this story began, and her son was just chronically not well and trying to struggle and figure out what's going on, and ultimately realized it was a food allergy, actually an allergy to quite a number of foods. And she ended up realizing that she wasn't going to be able to get access to the food she needed because where she lived, there just wasn't that kind of food around. It was what people sometimes refer to as a food desert. She went about the process of growing, among other things, corn in her backyard to the ridicule of a number of... But she ended up succeeding, and she ended up getting a lot of other people pretty excited about growing food. I see my friend Robert Pierce. Raise your hand, Robert. Great story, South Madison Farmers Market, and a lot of innovative agricultural techniques that he uses in Southside Madison, working with Hmong growers, African Americans, and others. And, you know, the point is, everybody deserves and has an interest in these issues, or can have an interest in these issues, if it's never brought to your attention. If LaDonna had not had a child who really, really needed a different food system, she wouldn't have worked to create one. if she hadn't had somebody who was able to help her diagnose the nature of her son's problems, I think we could say thanks to her pediatrician, probably, who helped her really help figure out the problem. So I would say it need not be precious. These issues, life is precious. Health is precious. For all of us, it should be precious in the most important sense of that word. Elitist, it doesn't need to be. It may well be that it starts and has started among the echelon that you're talking about. But it isn't really about my daughter's really kind of preferring this kind of a bean, not that kind of a bean. It's not about that. It's really about the very most essential aspects of... Oops, we were not supposed to wham the... Oops. Okay, so I'll just do it up to an inch from the surface. We are talking about the most essential aspects of human well-being, our health, our community justice. We're talking about our environment. We're talking about the well-being of the planet and of our own well-being, our economic well-being. That's not elitist. It is very likely something that we need to do educating about. Thanks to you all for coming today, because that means you all care about helping to bring these issues forward.
So I just want to add a couple points, too. My answer to your question is I certainly hope that that's not what we have here. And I'll echo what both my panelists said, which is maybe that's where it has to start. But if at the end of the day that's all it becomes, then in my mind we have failed. And my story that I told you about working in the south side of Chicago with underprivileged youth who had a myriad of behavior problems, and it's 15 years ago at this point for me, and it sticks in my mind crystal clear. I had this about 5-year-old boy one year in one of my classes, and his mother, his caretakers, sent for him to eat pretty much every day for lunch a package of Twinkies and a bag of Doritos. And that's what this child ate. Now, I think when I watch some of those behaviors that he exhibited, I wonder how much it had to do with that diet. And at the time, I wasn't as aware of some of those issues, and I just thought, you know, this is part of this child's acting out. But as I look back on that, you know, it really strikes me. And, of course, the issue there is the education is important, like Margaret brought up, but it's also an issue of access. And at that time, where he lived, I'm not sure he would have had access to good, fresh, healthy and wholesome food. So I think that this is a real issue that you're asking about, and it only will happen through education and continuing to make the case for why this kind of agriculture and the products that we're talking about need to be accessible to all.
Okay, how about on the right side right here, sir? Yes.
I'm a freelancer, former editor of Sierra Magazine. Just moved last week to Washington, D.C. And interested in knowing what, in addition to what we've already talked about, what are the interactions between what's going on the ground with sustainable agriculture and policy in Washington that the media should know about?
Okay, to repeat, the question is, what are the interactions between sustainable agriculture on the ground and policy in Washington now that media should know about, right?
Well, there are several, and you sometimes have the sense of the 5-year pulse in agriculture, which is to say every 4, 5, 6 years we have a farm bill, and you sort of have the impression that that's really the only thing that's happening in terms of policy that has direct bearing on the lives of people. In fact, that's not true. And I'll tell you a policy answer to that, and then I'll tell you the on-the-ground answer to that. From a policy perspective, when I just do my work plan, my annual work plan, I never am short of actively, you know, of things to do that are really critical. For example, when you work to get a farm bill, that is, of course, the galaxy of legislation dealing with food, agriculture, conservation, agriculture-related conservation, rural community development, and so forth. It's a very huge bill covering all sorts of sins. But When that bill passes, it's just about as good as the paper it's written on. It has no real meaning until it is implemented. There are programs that come out of the Farm Bill that say this is the rough sketch of what this program will look like, and it's very much up to the administration whether it's actually implemented. I'll give you a wonderful and painful example. Last Farm Bill, 2002, we worked like dogs to get a program through, which is called the Conservation Security Program, renamed in this Farm Bill, the Conservation Stewardship Program. That program came out. It was all about helping to reward farmers that were already doing the right thing in terms of conservation, and instead of, as I said earlier, paying farmers for growing more acres of a monocrop, which is really hard on the ground. You don't have any crop rotations. You're going to have a very hard time farming, really, without pesticides. You can't protect the soil as well. It's very much harder. Monocrops are really anathema, essentially, to sustainable agriculture. So finding a different approach to rewarding farmers for doing the right thing, something that's actually of interest to society, protecting our soils, supporting our environment, that program came out and then skidded along, was starting to go, and then clunk. It hit a rock wall, and we couldn't get the Bush administration to actually promulgate rules to write basically how it's going to look. And we pushed and we pushed and we pushed, and finally we did a huge, massive grassroots push and eventually got it kicked into gear. Then we had a, you may remember, Congress during that period that wasn't very supportive of this agenda, and we trying to get it funded took forever. So I will tell you, when we finally got that program funded, here's the on-the-ground example. We in Wisconsin, the Michael Fields Ag Institute, decided that one of the things that we ought to do is to help get the program better advertised by just going around and taking advantage of people who had already been selected to be enrolled in the program and have them talk about it, kind of give them a megaphone. We went to one farm up in the sort of the western part of the state, north of La Crosse. This farmer said, "This is the program I've been waiting for all of my farming years. This is the program that actually rewards me instead of penalizes me. This is the program that doesn't make me compete against other programs, other farmers who are going to always score higher because their manure problems are going to be greater than mine. Their potential environmental damage would be greater than mine, and so I'll never score against those. This is the program that's fair." So that's an example of, you know, why it matters. I could give you tons of examples. Value-added producer grant program. Wonderful farmer in the south, just west of here out in Blanchardville, Wisconsin. She's and her husband are starting up a high-end apple cidery. This is helping farmers around the area find new uses for the apples that they're growing. It's helping all sorts of people, beds and breakfasts, have a new product that they can use. It's creating permanent cover on that land, great for the environment and so forth. And the Value-Added Producer Grant Program spent a whopping $8,000 to help her get the business plan going and making it happen. The point is, the point of policy is not to be pointy-headed. The point of policy is to understand, to listen well to stakeholders and hear what are the real issues, what are the real problems, the real constraints to a sustainable future, and let's create programs that overcome those constraints and help people on the ground. And there are endless examples, and so if you ever want examples for radio programs or stories, we can deliver. There are lots of great stories of why policy helps leverage the biggest amassing of capital and collective resources to advance this agenda. That's what policy should be doing, to leverage our collective resources to support sustainable agriculture, and we've got tons of great examples.
So I'll follow. So Margaret, what do you say to those who say that the 5 to 6 year renewal cycle for the Farm Bill is basically useless? Less than a year ago, Wendell Berry and Wes Jackson wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying that we really need to have is a 50-year farm bill if you want to do things like control water pollution, preserve soil, get rid of dead zones, rethink the role of cereal crops, fund the research into perennial cereal crops, that we're using short-term mechanisms to solve long-term problems.
Well, that's a criticism you could level against any sector of society with regard to political change. It's always the incrementalism versus wouldn't it be great if I were the queen for the day and I could control the future of the planet. I mean, that's part of the tension of living in a democratic society, isn't it? And I understand that it is frustrating. I assure you, I understand that that's frustrating. But what I would say is our job is to create the collective consensus that these issues matter so that it's harder and harder for the interests who will make it very hard for us, who have made it very hard for us to gain gains, make it harder and harder for them to be the predominant message. If we can successfully communicate how many people actually do care about clean water. Have you just seen the New York Times this past week story? And actually, I was in Des Moines. The Des Moines Register covered the same story, that finally the EPA is going to take a look at the health impacts of atrazine, one of the most commonly used herbicides in the nation. And it's in groundwater. There have been reports now for 20, darn close to 20 years, maybe even a little longer, but I started hearing them about 20 years ago, some of the synergistic effects of atrazine on immune systems and other concerns. You know, isn't it appropriate that we should be having the population understand that? If that story weren't written, people wouldn't know it mattered. We need to get the word out that this matters and communicate to our members of Congress that, yes, we really do support an agenda of sustainability. That's how we, in a democratic society, are able to create momentum for a long-term future.
Okay, next. Anybody else who hasn't asked a question? Okay, left front. Thank you.
My name is Mike Purcell. I'm in a program for ag journalism at the University of Minnesota. And I wonder if you all would just help us clarify a couple of terms here and talk about how you would define sustainable agriculture and the family farm.
Okay, question is, what is the definition of sustainable agriculture and of family farm?
I'll talk a little bit about the family farm, and it's a great question, and it's one that internally in my organization we spent a lot of time thinking about and trying to decide what would that definition be, and in the end, we gave up. We didn't come up with a single definition that we felt could, you know, sort of embody what we mean when we say the family farm. Partially that is due to the different types of things that are being produced by our farmers, and it's also reflective of regional differences throughout the country. And somewhere inherent in that idea about family farm, there's something about scale. We certainly know that, but that's where we start to stumble, is what exactly on a measure of scale do we mean when we're talking about a family farm? And what it looks like in California is very different than what it looks like here in Wisconsin, and may even be different than what it looks like, let's say, in Vermont. So how do we get around that then? Or how do we reconcile ourselves with the fact that we can't put it on paper? One of the things that we do is every potential farm that's going to enter our organization is visited. And, you know, some of the folks that do some of that stuff, what they'll tell you is, I might not be able to write it down, but I sure know it when I'm on a family farm. So, you know, some of the things we're looking at are things like, where's the labor coming from? And it doesn't all have to be provided by the family. But we think that probably a vast majority of it should. And, of course, then you have questions like we have a very good farm that's located, I don't know, about 20 miles from here in Sun Prairie, and it's actually about four families working together. So the size is a bit bigger. You know, I told you that our average size is about 60 cows. I think they're milking 300 cows. But, again, you've got four or five families that have chosen to aggregate. And then we have a little bit different model where we've got four or five families in the southwest part of the state that are each with their own farmstead. But what they've chosen to do is pool resources for things like sharing machinery, sharing labor. So, you know, kind of that idea of, well, we got to get your hay in, so we'll go on your farm for a couple days, and when we're done there, we'll come over to my place and do it. So I can't give you a really succinct definition, and we've kind of reconciled ourselves to the fact that we don't have that, but we can certainly talk about what it is, and sometimes it's easier to talk about what it's not, what it isn't.
I'll speak to the topic of sustainable agriculture. 20 years ago, it seemed like I got asked this question all the time, and not from a sympathetic perspective. It was every time I was in a group and somebody was threatened by the implications of change that came along with the agenda of the sustainable agriculture community, their favorite way to try to puncture it was saying, "I don't really mean anything." You know, try to define it. We say, okay, well, this is what it means. And the interesting thing about sustainable agriculture is that the definition has arisen from practitioners all over the country caring about the same sets of issues. That's fascinating to me. It's not that anybody at some Google site decided that this is what it's going to be called. It's not Wikipedia's determination. It's actually come up from people, farmers in the lateritic soils of South Georgia and the North Mediterranean climate of North California and here in Madison and everywhere else, people saying, here are the things that I care about. Sustainable agriculture has to be profitable, and sustainable agriculture systems have to be profitable. They have to be socially responsible. This is the one that takes some deconstructing. I'm happy to do it if you're interested. It means all sorts of things. You can't do it on, the backs of unpaid and improperly treated labor, for example. You've got to consider the interests of your community, for example. Anyhow, environmentally sound, you want to protect the air. You don't really want to consider it it's sustainable if you are profitable and maybe socially responsible in your mind, but on the other hand, polluting the groundwater, mining the soil, harming the air of your neighbors. So the three most common characteristics are environmentally sound, socially responsible, profitable. I think that that's a pretty stable basis. It does require explanation, but I say to people that's okay. It really does. I have never been a strict person. Years ago, one of the people on our appropriations campaign was a guy from New Mexico. He was the House Appropriations Agriculture Subcommittee Chairman, Joseph Skeen. I had to find people in New Mexico who were going to be, good people to go in and meet with Joe Skeen. I called up this guy who had been recommended to me. He was a peanut grower. And I was looking for a person who, wore a tie and not Birkenstocks. And I talked to this guy. He knew the programs I wanted him to talk about, but he said, "I just want you to know that I spot spray my pesticides. I do spray. I'm not organic." And I said, great. His clear concern was that he was going to be considered not sustainable enough. It's all a continuum. I said, thank goodness that you've figured out how to do it in a way that is specifically, surgically determined by the specific parts of your field that you think need to be sprayed at what particular times you do. From my point of view, the less constructive aspects of sustainable agriculture deal with the exclusivist temperament that many of us have. We tend to have a dualistic urge to say, it's we, they, it's black, white, it's sustainable, it's unsustainable. One of the great things that happened when Michael Pollan came to Madison for our student undergraduate program read, which was his other book, one of his other books, which was In Defense of Food, was they had a debate, kind of a panel discussion. And there was a very large farmer, 2,500 cows up in northwest Wisconsin, who made a very compelling case of some of the most important strategies he's been using. Cut off nutrient runoff from his farm almost completely. Creating energy from his farm through a variety of means, manure digesters and others, et cetera. You don't have to be absolutist, but you do have to hold to those three simultaneously achieved principles.
Okay, we are over time, but Jay said we could go to 10:20, so if we have we have time for one more, and then I'm going to throw it to Dan Sullivan. Okay, I'll give it to you. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to mention, I don't know if anybody in this room went to the farm tour of Will Allen or Rowing College in Milwaukee, but I think that really answers the question of, is local food movement elite? And I don't think the Will Allen Growing Power operation is elite. And we also saw the Walnut Way yard garden operation, where student interns who are being paid are going out and helping people in the neighborhood grow food, harvest their food. So it seems like there's models out there to make this not elite. And my question has to do with the Child Nutrition Act. What would be the most important change that you would want to see in that Child Nutrition Act?
Okay, last question. What's the most important change that we'd like to see in the Child Nutrition Act?
Well, the single most useful thing for the farm to school movement will be getting mandatory funding. Mandatory, I can explain later on, but it basically means it isn't subject to the discretion of appropriators every year. Mandatory funding for a farm to school program. I'll say another critical issue that many school nutritionists will tell you is the determinant for them is enough money to reimburse for basic lunches. I could tell you the horror stories of how that money has gone down, down, down over the years relative to the economy. And frankly, it's just the budgets aren't there to allow any flex. Money is coming out of all sorts of other school budgets in order just to pay for school lunches because there isn't enough money. So those would be two really critical first steps.
Okay, we're at time. Thank you very much for attending and to our panelists. Do you have any last words, any of you? Margaret has one closing statement.
I have a policy. I'm really interested in having people. My hair thing is that I'm getting gray. And I go to meetings and I see everybody and I know everybody. This makes me very uneasy when I know all the people in the room. I want to see a lot of faces and young faces I don't know, and I'm really trying to cultivate new leaders, and I have a policy internship program that's gotten rave reviews from all the people who participated, and it's open right now for the springtime. If you know young people who you think this would be great for them, think of me. Check it out.
Okay, so we're going to close this part of it, and I'm going to turn it over to Dan Sullivan. He is a former editor at Rodale and at newfarm.org. Dan's in the back, and for any and all of you who are interested in going up to the square, he's happy to take you, answer your questions. I think he's meeting with another farmer up there who's going to help. Anyway, thank you all for your time. See you again soon.